In that chapter, I begin, I quote A.B. Bruce, who is a scholar of another century, but he said, "One who knows his weaknesses may become strong even at the weak point, but he who knows not his weak points cannot be strong at any point."
This podcast is brought to you by Blackaby Ministries International. To find out more, visit blackaby.org.
Well, welcome to the Richard Blackaby Leadership Podcast. My name is Sam, and I'm your host, and I'm joined by Dr. Richard Blackaby today.
Good to see you again, Sam.
It's always a pleasure, Richard. We are coming down to the wire. For those who are listening, if you're hearing this, you maybe got another few days to register for the Blackaby Coaching Workshop. It's going to be happening April 29th to May 1st at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that, Richard? You're going to be there?
I'll be there, at least for part of that. And it looks like we've got a great group coming in again. Usually if you have about 2 to 3 dozen folks, that's a really good size because you want to break into groups and practice and discuss stuff and real hands-on kind of training where they teach you and then you get to practice it. And we just find there's so many applications to leadership coaching. You know, again, whether you're a parent, you're just a friend that is trying to encourage folks to move forward with what God has for them, or if you are looking at a serious business of being a leadership coach, there's a whole range there we get of people. A lot of them that use it in their actual business and work, a lot of C-12 chairs, people that work for, various kinds of marketplace ministries, but...
Yeah.
And they just find it just very helpful. So, if you might be listening to this and wondering if that would apply to you, but the skills are great. The price is great. Very, very competitive anywhere you're going to find for leadership coaching training. But, not too late to sign up. And if you do come and, you heard this podcast, be sure to come up and introduce yourself to me while I'm around and love to meet you.
Absolutely. Well, as I tell folks, if they should do a coaching workshop, I say typically if you're working with people, it's of benefit. And so we certainly hope to see many new faces there at this one. But we'll have another one in the fall if you're not able to attend this one. And so we try and do at least 2 a year in the Atlanta area. And we've got a few more throughout the country this year.
Pennsylvania is one.
And I think... are we doing South Dakota this year?
Oh, I think so, yeah. So a couple in other states as well. So.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll leave links to that down in the show notes, and you can find out more at blackabycoaching.org. And speaking of Blackaby, you and your dad wrote a book called Spiritual Leadership many, many years ago.
Yeah.
It's been a while, I guess.
Leadership is really, as you know, if you listen to this podcast, is really my area. I was really privileged to be able to write a book, kind of our sort of classic thought collection on leadership. I originally wrote it in 2001, and it was very well received. It was it's been used as a textbook in all kinds of Christian schools and colleges and seminaries and. It's just made the rounds into political circles and other places. And so 10 years later, in 2011, it had been so widely used that we were asked to update it. And so I did. And, I took out about 100 pages of content, just trimming and tightening. But then I added about 200 pages back in and added 2 more chapters. So it's been updated quite a bit then, and it continues to be used. I've just contacted the other day by a seminary that's going to be using it as a primary textbook. And just a place where we've been able to assemble a lot of our key thoughts on leadership. Mm-hmm. And so what I thought we might do on several of these upcoming podcasts is just dig into some of the chapters and just kind of highlight those. I certainly encourage you to, if you haven't ever read the book, and get the updated one. It'll say revised and updated, expanded, and you'll get the latest updated thoughts. But I thought today maybe we look at chapter 12, and it's called The Leader's Pitfalls. What disqualifies leaders? And maybe kind of starting at a more negative spot, but I look at the world today. I look at the state of the United States, Canada. You look at the church and how it's doing, and you realize there's a dearth at times of leadership where you just think, where are the leaders who are solving problems? And where are the leaders who are just growing churches, growing nonprofits that would help society and so on, politicians that are solving issues? And you realize there's a huge shortage, and we desperately need more leaders. And then you wonder, and then you think about all the leaders who used to be leading that have fallen by the wayside. How many people that were pastors that aren't in the ministry anymore? People that fell into all kinds of different problems or got discouraged or got fired, and they're not serving anymore. And certainly we can't afford to lose people that God wired to lead. And so I want to look at just in this chapter written out like about 20 years ago, we first identified the 10 of the top reasons why leaders fail. And I'll tell you what, after 20 plus years, these are all still just key reasons, key issues. So just kind of dig into the pitfalls and we'll see how far we can get in this, the time allotted.
So here, there's 10, but it may be,
we might look at five, this
maybe
week,
but continued.
We'll
by the
see
time
how
we
it goes.
Reach the
but,
end of our...
In that chapter, I begin, I quote A.B. Bruce, who is a scholar of another century, but he said, "One who knows his weaknesses may become strong even at the weak point, but he who knows not his weak points cannot be strong at any point." And you have to kind of meditate upon that a little bit, but what he's saying is if you don't know where you're weak, you're going to be, it doesn't matter how many strengths you have, because you're always going to be vulnerable to that weak spot. And I've certainly seen that, where there's some leaders who can do amazing things in so many different areas, but then they come crashing down because their Achilles heel was struck, and it's game over for them. But he says, if you know where you're weak, if you know where you're vulnerable, so that you guard against it, you protect yourself, you address it, then it doesn't matter. If you don't have a lot of strengths, you're going to be able to continue to be effective. And so I think every leader has got to be self-aware, both of your strengths and your weaknesses. But your strengths won't necessarily bring you down. Your weaknesses will. So you've got to always have those in front of you. And I mean, leaders are always addressing weaknesses, but you're not going to necessarily get them all solved right away. Some of that takes maybe years of work and coaching and other things, but at least you tread carefully around those weaknesses and you guard against them. So let me just kind of walk through some of the different issues or pitfalls. And one of those, the first one we led with is pride. And we kind of say that pride may be the most destructive, the most pervasive of all the different pitfalls. Obviously, leaders don't suffer from all 10, or if you do, you're really in pretty desperate condition. But pride is going to be one of the real common ones. And of course, there's varying degrees of pride. Some people are just bloated with pride. Others, it just sort of creeps in now and then at certain moments. But we kind of look at just what is it that pride does to a leader? And of course, it can do a number of things. We list about five things that pride can do. One is it disorients leaders. Leaders have got to be able to clearly see themselves and to see their situation. But pride has a way of disorienting you to reality. You're going to see yourself differently than you really are. You'll see yourself as being more indispensable. I've known leaders that became very abusive to their staff, very reckless in the way they conducted themselves, but they just felt like, but my organization can't live without me. I'm indispensable, so I can kind of get away with murder. And then oftentimes they find out that's not true, and they get sent packing. Or it can disorient them to think that they're doing better than they really are. Maybe the organization is floundering, but pride makes you think, boy, it would be even a lot worse if I wasn't here. And so it takes you out of touch with reality. And so, of course, leaders have got to be specialists in reality. You've got to be able to see how things are and then say, well, you know, you can't fix something if you can't see it clearly. So pride just has a way of making you appear a lot more important and indispensable than you really are. And oftentimes it's going to make you view people as less indispensable, less important, less valuable. And so once you're not seeing reality clearly, you're vulnerable. Second thing is pride also just makes leaders feel make them unteachable. Of course, if you are the leader, if you've had success, then you see yourself as the expert, and you begin to feel like I don't need to have a teacher. I need to teach others. Leaders tend to talk a lot more than they listen. They tend to give advice more than they seek advice. And that's something that pride does. And that's why the great leaders seek to maintain humility, that they, no matter how successful they become, how respected they become, that they still keep a posture of humility where they realize they have a lot to learn. I remember, I may mention this before, I was doing a conference with a friend in Louisiana several years ago, and we were meeting in a large church, large facility, and it was a conference on churches that are struggling. And so obviously we're on the campus of a very successful, growing, big church, but they were gracious to host a conference to help pastors who were struggling, who needed help. And there was this kind of older man, looked to me like, I just sort of guessed he must be a retired pastor and maybe a minister that just wanted to see what he could pick up and learn. And so he was there, I met him, and so he had his notepad out. He sat there at the table all the sessions, all morning into the afternoon. And ultimately I learned that he wasn't a retired pastor. He was a current pastor, and he was actually the pastor of that church, the host church. And it's like, you clearly don't need to, you know, you're not struggling with a church that's in decline. Your church obviously is growing and prospering. But so why are you sitting there with a notepad open, taking notes? Because that's clearly not your issue. But he was a pastor that was always open to learning from whoever it was. And since his church was hosting a meeting, he thought, what a great opportunity for me maybe to learn something. He was older than I was, more experienced, certainly as a pastor. But he thought he might still learn something that I might say. And I came away just so impressed with the humility of that. It's rare, honestly, to see that. Typically, even if the pastor is hosting the meeting, he may be in his office or feel he's too busy or might just pop in and out. But this guy just sat right in there and just totally immersed himself in the conference. And there's just a lot of leaders that just would think they were too busy to do that. It takes humility. And also several sort of connected things, but it also leads to a sense of self-sufficiency. You just don't need anybody else. And I've seen that happen in many different ways where leaders, it may well have been that they had some key lieutenants that helped them to be successful, but they begin to think, no, it's just really me. And they'll fire key vice presidents or leaders in the organization. They'll run them off. They won't show appreciation for them or give them credit for what they've done. And then when they leave, suddenly things start going south and the leader begins to face the harsh reality. Oh, I guess this wasn't just about me. I guess actually much of my success comes from the people that were working with me. But I assumed that I didn't need them. I assumed that I was the author of all this success. And then two others, it also can lead to a loss of compassion. Pride is really being self-centered. It's focused on yourself. And the more self-focused you are, the less others focused you are. And you begin to think that it's about you. And so I've seen this in business and nonprofits where, you know, literally you can have a guy leading a nonprofit that's being paid millions of dollars to like help the homeless or something. And they barely have the resources to actually do their job because it's all about him and remunerating him well. And sometimes it's just a pride thing to say this whole organization really is built around me. And instead of having compassion for your staff, your employees, and there's other times where leaders have taken cuts in pay, but then not cut the pay of the people on the ground floor and said, hey, you can take $1 million of my income and I'll still be making a decent living. But these folks are, you know, it's a real tight budget right now with the inflation and so on. And so pride, you can always tell when you stop caring about the people you work with, the people you serve. Pride may be the culprit for that. And then finally, just pride makes leaders vulnerable. Of course, if you're not seeing reality properly, you're vulnerable. But and it's been said of people like Julius Caesar that he became so proud and so confident that he didn't take danger seriously. And on the Ides of March, when he was going to be famously assassinated, there were people who warned him about that. He warned him to be cautious, that there was stirrings and word of a possible murder attempt. And Caesar dismissed his bodyguard. He came in without even his bodyguard. He was so dismissive of his enemies. And because he had an overblown view of himself and his power, his invincibility, of course, he came down famously under a rain of dagger blows. And that pride led to his death, which was unnecessary. If he'd had his bodyguard, if he had heeded people's warnings and advice, he would have lived to see another day. But so we could say a lot about pride. But and I think part of the reason that pride is so pervasive for leaders is that leaders, if you're very good at all, you're going to experience success. You're going to experience growth. And people beneath you on the organizational chart are going to be fawning over you and telling you what you want to hear, and you can get criticized for sure, but you also get praised. And if you are susceptible to pride, it's just going to fan that pride into a flame. Not everybody can handle leadership roles because pride is just too easy to grow in someone like that. So the first two pitfalls, particularly the first one, pride. We say is more certainly the most pervasive, perhaps, of all the pitfalls. But the second one may be the most notorious, and that would be sexual sin. And of course, we're all familiar with prominent leaders, pastors, politicians, other leaders that fell into sexual immorality in particular. And one of the things that makes that pitfall so devastating is it not only is, I guess, is that it harms so many people. Mm-hmm. I mean, pride can too, but sexual immorality, of course, it's going to harm you. It could cause you to lose your job, could lose your career. It's obviously going to hurt your spouse that you betray in the process. And of course, so many times people, it's the very spouse that you vowed before God and witnesses to love and sickness and health and so on, and then pride, lust, whatever else can convince you to that doesn't, it's not binding for you, and so you betray that person. Of course, if you have kids, it's devastating on them. It's devastating on your organization. I've known organizations where key vice presidents had adulterous relationships, and several of them ended up losing their jobs or causing all kinds of conflict among the leadership team. It certainly reflects poorly on God if you're a Christian organization or you're a pastor. There's many victims when it comes to sexual sin. We You know, of course, it's always presented as, well, these are just two people who love each other. But the devastation, the harm, the hurt, the pain is so acute that it's just very clear that it's you're blinded into destructive behavior. And in this chapter, Dad and I looked at about five things you can do to protect yourself from that. And we've said this before, and sometimes people really take exception to this, but like all these pitfalls, we would tend to say, don't ever feel like you're somehow invulnerable to them, that you're, mm-hmm. that this just isn't my issue. I would never do this. I could give you a list of pastors that wrote books on how to protect yourself from sexual sin, and then they committed sexual sin. But under the right circumstances, when you're at a weak point, a certain type of temptation or whatever else, certain opportunity, and suddenly you find yourself falling. And so every leader needs to have some safeguards. And I would say probably safeguards against all manner of downfall, such as financial mismanagement as well. But in terms of sexual sin, one thing is just, I think the key one is just make yourself accountable. And I've just seen so many times where if you see a leader who falls into sexual sin, almost invariably, you're going to find that they had nobody that was holding them accountable. They were meeting with women one-on-one, and nobody was in a position to challenge that or ask questions, or they maybe the senior pastor had all the staff put windows in their office door, but they didn't have a window. Or maybe they did, but their office was so big that they could sit in whole sections of their office where no one could see through that window. And I've heard all manner of stories where there might have been organizations with high accountability for everybody else, but then not the leader. And the leader ought to set the example for accountability, whether it's for financial spending or certainly any kind of sexual issues. And second is, I just tell, especially when it comes to sexual sin, is leaders just need to keep their own counsel, especially pastors. I've never known a pastor yet who committed sexual sin that didn't know that it was wrong and hadn't probably warned others about not becoming involved in that behavior. They know what to do. They knew how to avoid that. It just, at a certain point, they just chose not to. They succumbed to the temptation themselves. But it's rare that you commit sexual sin and don't know that it's wrong, and you don't know how you could have avoided it had you wanted to. A third one is just consider the consequences. And I've always found that to be a good path for any kind of inappropriate behavior is if you start to feel tempted, and of course, temptation itself is not necessarily the same as a sin. Being tempted isn't the same as actually committing that transgression. But temptation is, I mean, even Jesus was tempted, which mm-hmm. is kind of an interesting thought, really, in a sense. He was tempted, but he did not yield to that temptation. So if you do feel thoughts that are tempting you, I think it's very good just to consider the consequences. Think through, okay, if I were to follow through with this temptation, if I were to just go ahead and do this, what would that lead to? And certainly with sexual temptation, you know, the temptation might be enticing you with, wouldn't this be exciting and fun and whatever? But then think beyond that moment. Think about when the moment's over. Think about going home, facing your spouse. Consider what it would be like to when you are found out, and now you have to face your spouse that you betrayed. Think about when your kids look you in the eye and say, "Dad or Mom, how could you do that?" And think about now when maybe you're not living with your kids anymore because now you're separated from your spouse. And think about standing in front of your congregation and confessing to them why you have to step down now from your job because you gave in to that temptation. Think about what that's like when you've got an asterisk by your name that despite all the good that you did, what you're remembered for now is your moral failure. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I could list a long, long list of pastors and other prominent leaders that did lots and lots of good things, but they will now forever be known for that perhaps just momentary failing, that momentary succumbing to that temptation that they have to now live with the rest of their life. And I'll tell you what, you start to contemplate some of the consequences for giving in to sexual sin, and you just realize it's just not good enough for all the negative that comes with it. And so consider that, and then just the two other ones, develop healthy habits, just habits that protect you. And again, you need to do this for every area of your life, whether it's your own physical health, but certainly your moral health. And Billy Graham, of course, was famous for this. Just had several rules that he set for himself. And I don't know that Billy Graham necessarily intended for everybody or thought everybody had to just follow the same rules he did. I think he would have just said, just have rules, just prayerfully consider what habits will work for you. But of course, for Billy Graham and his team, they never were alone with a woman that wasn't their wife. They had all kinds of safeguards for handling money. They tried to just avoid the appearance of evil. In our day, it's not enough just avoiding evil. You have to avoid the appearance of evil, that you could even be falsely accused later, and you need to be protected even from falsehood, from the appearance of having done something wrong, which causes you to have to go to a higher standard as far as the kind of habits that you're maintaining. And people might, and this has happened. I think Mike Pence, the former vice president, was ridiculed for sort of following the Billy Graham rule. And people made fun of him for that. There may be people who really question you. They might even be offended that you would even have that standard. Maybe applying, if you're a man and you don't want to meet alone with a woman, that woman might be offended that you'd even, think that she might be a temptation to you or that she would consider that. But you just have to, in the end of the day, just say, but regardless of what other people think, my focus is making sure that I'm just safeguarded from this ever happening. So think through carefully, talk with others about maybe some ways they safeguard. I know I work a lot with business people who have to go on business travel, and a lot of times there'll be people of the opposite sex on their team that's in a hotel and going out for dinner or somewhere, and they've got to figure out how they can keep themselves safe and honor their spouse and honor God. And then the last one is just maintain a healthy, growing walk with God. God certainly knows how you're vulnerable, and he knows how to protect you. He knows you better than you do. You may feel like, I think I'm okay with this. I think I could handle that. And God might be saying, no, I know how you're wired. I know you wouldn't last 10 minutes under this circumstance. So don't let yourself get in that circumstance. And again, I could tell you some very, very prominent leaders, prominent pastors, you would never in a million years have thought that they would commit that kind of sin. But I suppose they also thought not in a million years would they ever do that, and until they did. And so, but I found that if you truly are heeding the voice of the Holy Spirit, he will be constantly warning you, preparing, guiding you, alerting you if there's temptation. And there's been times in my life, and again, I don't want to, super spiritualize myself or anything, but because I've not always been perfect at this, but there have been times where I've just felt uncomfortable, just awkward, or there are just for different reasons. But there are just times where you just feel like the Spirit of God is just turning that red flashing light on in your spiritual dashboard, and you just realize, okay, there's something's not right here. And of course, you can't know what's in the heart of someone. If you're a man, you can't necessarily know what's in the heart of women. Men are notoriously bad sometimes at picking up what's in the heart, what the intentions of a woman are, and vice versa. I mean, a woman sometimes has no idea does this man, is he just being nice, or is he thinking more than just being nice? And all of a sudden you start to realize, okay, I don't like where this conversation's going. This type of humor seems a little inappropriate for this setting. This person's standing a little too close to me, whatever it might be. I've just found that if you're walking closely to the Holy Spirit, if you heed His voice, he'll be trying to protect you. He'll be trying to warn you. And one thing I have just come for several reasons just to try to practice is just take all those promptings seriously. You might not even understand it. You might be second guessing yourself. You might be saying, "Oh, am I just reading too much into this?" My word of advice would be just take any prompting of the Holy Spirit seriously. Always better to be safe than sorry. And mm-hmm. So if you sense a discomfort, maybe I'm just being a prude, you might think. Maybe I'm just reading too much into this. Surely this person is a man or woman of God that would never do such a thing. But still, in your spirit, you just sense the Spirit's warning you. Then I would just say, just better to just always just follow the impulse of the Spirit. And if He says, "Hey, call it a night," just decline that invitation to go out for coffee or to do this or that, or for Him to give you a ride home or whatever it might be. Just trust that the Holy Spirit is desperately trying to protect you from something that you might greatly regret, or at least protect you from getting into a really awkward situation that's going to be very, very difficult and painful to get out of. He's trying to protect you at the front end, so you suddenly don't find yourself in a really bad place where now it's going to be very difficult to get out. So I guess Sam, we got through about two of these, but these are the two big ones, really.
Yeah.
Some of the other ones maybe we can go through a little quicker, but you know, sometimes you hear some of this, you think, "Oh yeah, that's all basic. That's all, I know all that." But yet, these two issues continue to be at epidemic proportions among leaders. Yeah. In the church, sadly, but also in the business world, the professional worlds. And so I think you just have to periodically circle back around and say, so just kind of like you'd be checking your, maybe each year you check your insurance policies and say, "Do I have enough coverage? Am I safe? Do I need to beef something up?" I think the same thing when it comes to things that could endanger you personally, your career, your leadership. Just maybe circle back around periodically and say, "How am I for sexual sin protection? How am I for becoming prideful protection? Do I need to add some extra coverage? Do I need to change some things so that I'm safe?" Because I would hate to succumb to either one of those.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised at all with the number of things that we got through today's podcast, but we'll keep plowing ahead in future podcasts, and I appreciate you taking the time to go through this, Richard. And as always, we'll leave links to everything we mentioned, especially the Spiritual Leadership book. That'll be in the show notes. And until next time.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If this is something you enjoyed, it really makes a difference if you leave a review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. We always love hearing from our listeners, so email us at podcast@blackvee.org.